Okay, Tobias and I agree that we're not going to introduce people twice over. So if you don't know who I am, ask somebody next to you. So in this presentation, I want to add to the didactic work that Pascal did in his lecture yesterday, talking about the way in which the ear does its amplification. And we'll subsequently try to make the work that we're presenting about single cells with the story of what happens with the traveling wave and the more complex phenomena of the mammalian cochlea. Now, Tobias Reichenbach will be talking about the phenomenology of the traveling wave on Monday, so we've wanted to defer things until after that. So probably on Tuesday afternoon, we'll have a discussion section in which Dick Lyons also has some things to contribute, in which we will talk about how the single cell work and the traveling wave work can be reconciled, we hope, and how the Hopf bifurcation may be something underlying the phenomenology that are seeing in both systems. And Pascal also wants to contribute to that latter discussion. So I thought I would begin by reminding you something about the energetics of sensory transduction, just to point out the particular task that the ear faces. And I've contrasted hearing in this instance with vision. In the case of vision, when you capture or a cell captures a single photon, that photon has on the order of 400 zeptojoules of energy. That is 100 times KT. So it's enormously energetic compared to the background thermal noise. And as a consequence, it's possible to make a detector that's extremely reliable. In other words, a detector that has a very low noise rate, simply because the energy is so great that it's not too likely that a thermal signal near KT will be confused. So the way in which visual systems work is to have first a transduction step that takes advantage of this very high energy and very reliably produces a second messenger of some sort. Then, subsequently, there are a set of amplification steps that produce finally the receptor potential. So this involves, for example, cyclic GMP and other intermediates in the case of our own vision. Let's contrast that with hearing. In this case, as you heard yesterday, the threshold is around 3/10 of a nanometer of vibration. And the energy in that instance is a fraction of 1 kT for every cycle. So first of all, that is of course undetectable by itself. So it's important that one be able to average over multiple cycles. And it's therefore, as Pascal pointed out yesterday, useful for hearing organs to be resonant in quality so that they can accumulate energy over multiple cycles. The other point is that detecting that a sound has been heard, has been captured, is equivocal. You're always operating very close to this noise level. So as a consequence, one can't be absolutely sure of a detection. And what the auditory system, at least the vertebrate system, has done, and apparently that of some arthropods such as dipterans, is to have a system in which transduction and amplification are tied together. In other words, a system in which there is positive feedback that amplifies the input, including the noise, and tries to determine whether the final product is indicative of a real signal or not, and then engenders a receptor potential. Now, as is shown yesterday, again in Pascal's talk, most of the work that's been done on the central, on the auditory system of mammals involves experiments of the sort schematized here, in which one makes a small perforation into the cochlea through the bone, and then directs a laser beam onto the basilar membrane. The reflected light then comes back into an interferometer, and by that means one can measure very sensitively the vibrations of the basilar membrane. And these vibrations include this entire structure. The pressure difference appears across the basilar membrane, so between this paralymph-containing compartment and this endolymph-containing compartment. This whole apparatus, which includes the organ of Corti, moves up and down. And the shearing motion between the hair cells here and the inner hair cell and the overlying tectorial membrane deflects the hair bundles and gives rise to an electrical response of the sort that I described yesterday. Now, when one makes measurements of this sort of basilar membrane motion, one finds, rather strikingly, evidence for something called the active process of the cochlea, or the active process of hair cells. Jeff Manley was the person who first pointed out that these four features tend to occur together, and that this is universal among at least the tetrapods. So amphibians, reptiles, including birds, and mammals, all manifest these four qualities in their sensory hearing organs. So if we record at a particular place along the basilar membrane, that is to say, if we make a recording at one spot and one spot only, we can then play sounds of different frequencies to see what sort of response they engender. So here is the frequency that's being played, here's the amplitude of the response, and these are log-log plots. So the first characteristic of the active process is amplification. At any particular place, there will be one specific frequency called the best or characteristic frequency that gives rise to the largest response. And if the animal dies, or if its blood supply is compromised, the response will fall to this much lower level. And this being logarithmic, it turns out that the amplification is of the order of 100 to 1,000 fold, typically on the order of 300. So it's a very strong amplification, a built-in biological hearing aid, if you will. The second characteristic is frequency tuning. So in a normal cochlea at any given particular place, there will be a sharp response that is limited in its frequency width. Higher frequencies are cut out, lower frequencies are largely rejected. If the animal dies, again, we will have this very broad tuning. And if we now make the sound louder by 350 times, we would get this very broad curve. So even though the peak response is the same, we get this much, much poorer frequency resolution. And this, in fact, turns out to be why hearing aids are so unsatisfactory. For people whose hearing is deteriorated, they've gone from this red curve to something like the blue curve. You can make the sound louder, but they won't be satisfied with that. Yeah, Andrew. You mean a difference in these slopes, or?
Exactly, yeah. So since it's logarithmic, shouldn't the higher frequency be much steeper if the selectivity is the same above and below?
Yeah, and so you're right. The fact of the matter is, in the entire cochlea with the traveling wave, the high frequency cutoff is much sharper than the low frequency cutoff. This is schematic, and I'm not trying to worry about details of the traveling wave in these representations. The third characteristic is what's called compressive nonlinearity. So here the point is that if you stimulate at the best frequency and now make the sound louder by 10-fold or by 100-fold, the response does not grow in proportion, it grows to a much smaller extent. If on the other hand you stimulate off the best frequency, you find that the system is linear. A 10 or 100-fold increase causes a proportional increase in the size of the oscillation. So this compression is useful in, as we discussed yesterday, in the fact that a very large range of inputs, a trillion-fold range of sound power, can be compressed into just about two orders of magnitude in output. And the fourth characteristic is a quite weird one, that's spontaneous otoacoustic emission. So many animals, including 70% of normal hearing humans, have ears that will emit sound in a suitably quiet environment. So about half of normal human ears in 70% of people will do this. Typically, one sees a few emission peaks. They're relatively sharp. They're not possible to predict. Your left ear will be different from your right. Andrew's will be different from Florian's, and so on. But they tend to be stable over time. So if your ear isn't damaged, you will continue to have the same sort of biomorphic set of peaks throughout your life. So the question is, how do all these things arise, and what common features do they have, and what explains the fact that they seem to be universal, at least among tetrapods?
Question about the compressive.
Yes.
Marginalized out.
Well, no, it's still quite relevant. I mean, if I turn the sound down lower, what would happen is that these areas would go into the noise level, which is, you know, arbitrary on this diagram. So at still lower levels, we would see a nested set of peaks like this going all the way down. So at low levels of stimulation, there would be a peak that is above noise only in the region of the characteristic frequency, and nowhere else would there be any response at all. Okay, so you can think of not, in this case, two orders of magnitude of amplitude, but a total of six orders of magnitude in amplitude going all the way on down. So what does the hair bundle have to do with this? It turns out that when one begins to record from individual hair bundles, even of cells from the frogs here, one finds manifestations of all four of these characteristics of the active process. So the first of these is amplification. And this can be measured, as I mentioned before, by applying a fine glass probe to the hair bundle, monitoring its position with a photodiode, and then taking advantage of the fact that we can move the base of the fiber, deflecting the hair bundle, and measuring the force that the bundle produces. So first, amplification is shown by applying such a fiber to the hair bundle. When the hair bundle is not being stimulated, it simply rattles around in this noisy way. But as soon as the stimulus begins, moving the base of the fiber, we find that the tip of the fiber nicely phase locks with that stimulus, and you can see that the response shows amplification. This response is roughly plus or minus 20 nanometers, though the stimulus is only plus or minus 10 nanometers. And one could be more rigorous about the amplification by just applying simple physics. The sum of the forces at the top of the hair bundle has to be zero. So this includes external force, namely the forcing by the stimulus fiber. It includes the forces of Newton's law, so the inertial, the drag, and the elastic terms. And it includes any putative active force that the hair bundle is producing. In other words, if the hair bundle is in fact an amplifier, that would show up in this active term. Over a cycle, the conservative forces, namely the inertial and the elastic ones, should cancel out. So we're left with the simple fact that any active force that the hair bundle produces is equal and opposite to the force owing to the fiber's work against the bundle and the work that the bundle dissipates on viscous drag. And it's possible to measure those two things. So first of all, one can measure the work that is done on the hair bundle by drag. So these are actual experimental records. Here's the drag power as a function of time. And you'll notice it's always negative, as it had better be. It is always going to be dissipation as the hair bundle moves back and forth through the viscous medium. So the integral over a cycle is minus 39 zeptojoules. So the minus sign connoting the fact that energy is being lost by the hair bundle to the environment. If one now measures the work done on the hair bundle by the fiber, surprisingly, it is also negative in sign. So even though the fiber is applied to the hair bundle and is stimulating it, the hair bundle is actually doing work against the fiber rather than vice versa. So if we sum those two, we find that in this case, the active work on average per cycle is about 80 zeptojoules. And as a reality check, in this experiment, which was done by Pascal, he started out looking at another hair bundle and saw at the beginning there was negative work owing to drag and negative work on balance owing to the work on the fiber. And in this case, the active contribution was 40 zeptojoules. But after he flogged this bundle for about an hour, it got tired and it gave up. So at the end of that hour, the net active work was roughly zero. In other words, the dissipation against the viscous load was equal and opposite to the work that was being done by the fiber to make the hair bundle move. So the numbers all add up. The hair bundle really is an active amplifier, and it's active in the sense that it produces power. It injects power into the surrounding environment. Next, there's tuning. In an individual hair bundle, when spontaneously oscillating or when stimulated, shows a particular characteristic frequency. So this bundle was peaking at a frequency that's on the order of 10 hertz. Once again, it's a low frequency bundle from the frog's hair cell. And you can see that the response falls off at higher frequencies. A passive bundle or a dead one shows a much, much smaller response. There's compressive nonlinearity. So this is a linear plot of the sensitivity of the hair bundle as a function of the size of the stimulus. Again, a passive hair bundle shows a constant relationship. It's simply an elastic element with no soul to it. The active bundle shows this very strong compression with the maximum sensitivity for the smallest stimulus and then progressively lesser sensitivity approaching this asymptote for very large stimuli. And if one shows similar data on doubly logarithmic plots, as Pascal did yesterday, one finds that the response of the system as a function of the input follows this one-third power law over the range where we do most of our hearing, from a couple of nanometers to about 100 nanometers of deflection. Or the sensitivity, which is the output divided by the input, follows this slope of minus two-thirds in the power law relation. And finally, there's spontaneous emission. So again, as you've seen yesterday, the hair bundle undergoes spontaneous oscillations. This small one is oscillating relatively quickly and rhythmically. This large one is moving more slowly and more erratically. And if you put a fiber on these, you can measure different tempos of oscillation. Some bundles are sort of metronomic in their regularity. Some are slow and some are fast. Some are one-sided. Others are relatively ratty looking. And some show rather slow relaxation oscillations with fast and slow complements to them. And Dolores Bosevich, who's here now, has extensively analyzed these different behaviors, and she'll be, I expect, talking about this in a subsequent presentation. Now, briefly, where does this come from? I mentioned yesterday that as a result of this regime of negative stiffness, the hair bundle has stable fixed points here and here, but it's unstable in between. And there are various adaptation mechanisms that push the hair bundle into this regime and make it jump one way or the other. And that back and forth motion can then produce an oscillator or an amplifier. The two mechanisms that are involved are those called adaptation. So remember, slow adaptation involves the downward sliding of the tops of the tip links when the hair bundle is pushed in the positive direction, allowing transduction channels to reclose. When the hair bundle is pushed in the negative direction, the upward climbing, probably based on myosin 1C, restores tension to the links, and again, it produces an adaptive process. Now, these myosin-based processes operate at relatively low frequencies. We don't think myosin can operate much above a few tens to maybe a few hundred hertz at the most. So we still do not understand how adaptation occurs at high frequencies. All we know is that it's calcium dependent, and as I said before, calcium enters, it binds. The binding of calcium causes the hair bundle to jerk back in the negative direction. So this system pumps energy into a hair bundle and allows it to amplify. One can describe the dynamics of such a hair bundle by various equations, and Pascal introduced you to several yesterday. This is a very closely related set of equations, and I should say that all of these have sort of a common origin. Dolores helped write down the original set of these. There was a redimensionalization of them by Pascal, Frank Hulicker, and others. But, and this is from David L. Melody's work, but basically they all have in common the fact that one has a hair bundle velocity that is determined by various drag coefficients, the drag on the hair bundle and the fiber attached to it. There's something representing the gating of the channel, and again, there's a cubic nonlinearity that's very characteristic of that. There are elastic forces owing to the hair bundle and the stimulus fiber. And finally, there's whatever external force one wishes to provide. And then there's an adaptation process. And in this case, it's very simple. There's a relationship in which adaptation is directly proportional to the difference between the displacement and the adaptation variable with a particular time constant.
So the fact that the channel gating force is this linear plus this cubic term, that's basically an approximation of a sigmoidal relationship.
That's right, exactly.
Around the 50% for the whole probability around that symmetry point.
That's right. And so this is the relation you've seen several times in my talk in Pascal's, Namely, it's a relationship roughly like that, with the linear component, the Hookean component, and the cubic added to that.
But it's also assuming that basically the tail bundle is at that symmetry point where the opening, because it comes from the opening probability of ion channels, right? That's kind of
Yes. Assuming
that nonlinearity, and so it must be assumed that that is at that point where 50% of the channels are open, 50% are closed.
Right.
Otherwise, you would get some quadratic term as well.
Right? That's right. And this is something, again, that will be interesting to discuss next Tuesday. The evidence is that in the intact cochlea, the outer hair cells, which have the amplificatory function, do operate exactly at that point, right at an open probability of 50%. The other hair cells that are the inner hair cells responsible for actually conveying information to the brain seem to operate at a much lower open probability, probably between 10 and 20%. And evolution seems to have three times discovered a principle of separating two functions, the amplification function, a la the outer hair cells, and the signaling function, a la the inner hair cells. And it may well be for exactly this reason, that it's advantageous to do amplification about that point, the 50% symmetry point, but it's best to do signaling at a different point, and we can discuss why. So that simple model and related models have the property that if you give the hair bundle in a model a weak stimulus, a passive bundle will produce a very small deflection indeed. Even if the channels can open and close, the response gets only about twice as big. But if you now add the feedback, owing to calcium entry and binding, you see amplification. The amplification is on the order of 100-fold to 1,000-fold. And as Pascal pointed out, this is purchased at the expense of a delayed response. So the system acts like a resonator. It's not, however, a passive, but rather an active resonator. The system is highly tuned, so there'll be, for a given set of parameter values, one frequency at which it responds best, and it shows compressive nonlinearity. So the sensitivity, or the gain, becomes progressively smaller as the stimulus becomes progressively bigger. And finally, the system undergoes a Hopf bifurcation. So if we give constant stimuli, but change the control parameter in an appropriate way, the response will get bigger and bigger until we cross the bifurcation, the system becomes unstable, and then it will emit limit cycle in, oscillations indefinitely. So here's a quick summary. First, the normal form of the Hopf bifurcation, which we'll discuss in more detail next week. In circumstances in which we are operating near the bifurcation and near resonance, and this is in the absence of noise, the system produces amplification and compressive nonlinearity. If there's no stimulus, then the control parameter determines what happens. If it's negative, the system is simply quiescent. If it's positive, then the system shows a limit cycle. There are a number of reasons a Hopf bifurcation may have been discovered by nature. It has advantages. So the main advantages are the characteristics that are associated with the active process, namely amplification of 100 to 1,000-fold, very sharp frequency resolution on the order of 0.1 to 0.2%, and finally compressive nonlinearity, squeezing a million-fold range of inputs into a range of 100-fold in outputs. This bifurcation is relatively simple. It requires only a two-dimensional system. It's of codimension one, which means that tweaking one control parameter can take one across the bifurcation. So biology, or cells, aren't required to do anything terribly elaborate to blunder into this oscillation or into this bifurcation. They can do so rather innocently if they simply have this property of two-dimensional oscillations and the ability to move a parameter, which is the control parameter. It's a local bifurcation that occurs about a fixed point. The system is capable of relatively easy entrainment. There are some bifurcations in which the response is not easily entrained. Here's a system in which, when you're forcing it, it relatively easily latches onto the stimulus, and that, again, is desirable in an auditory system. And it has what I've called frequency constancy, which is to say that typically, as you move across the Hopf bifurcation, The frequency to which the system is most responsive on the passive side is similar to or identical to the frequency at which it oscillates spontaneously after you cross the bifurcation. And this is useful, potentially, in an auditory system, in that as the sound gets louder or softer and your sensitivity goes up or down, you don't want the pitch value of sounds to change. So if something becomes louder, you don't want it to go greatly sharp or greatly flat. You would like for it to stay roughly constant in its pitch value, and this system conduces to that. And finally, this system spins off two epiphenomena that are characteristic of our auditory systems. The distortion products or combination tones, such as were demonstrated yesterday, and spontaneous otoacoustic emissions that I've just discussed. Now, if you look at different hair cells, they confront different environments. So in the lateral line organ, there are hair bundles sticking up out of the surface of a fish or amphibian, surrounded by a gelatinous coat of soft material. These respond to water motion. They're very similar apparatus inside our semicircular canals, where the water motion is that associated with rotatory motions of the head or the body. So here we have a relatively soft load imposed by water motion. In the otolith organs, our utricle and saccule, there's a very stiff membrane sitting on top of the hair bundles and attached to them. And above that, there are rocks, calcium carbonate crystals. So these constitute an inertial load, and we measure linear accelerations owing to motions of our body or owing to gravity by this apparatus. And finally, in the cochlea, we have this complicated apparatus in which everything bounces up and down, and shear between the tectorial membrane and the hair cells excites these rather complicated hair bundles. So one wonders how these different types of cells accommodate these different loads. And we, in fact, can experimentally approach this because we have control of two parameters. We can control the external stiffness that is applied to the system, and we can control the external force. And this is done by this feedback system, a mechanical load clamp. Again, we have the fiber applied to the hair bundle. A signal is generated from the displacement of the bundle and compared to a command signal, and then through a piezoelectric actuator, force is fed back to this fiber to move the bundle as we wish. And there are two things we can do. First, if we want to just apply a force to the hair bundle, that's no trick at all, right? So we simply have our probe, we have the hair bundle here, and we move the flexible fiber a certain distance to your right. That will bend the fiber and produce a force that moves the hair bundle in that direction. And we can quantitate that force by how much this bends. A little more subtle is clamping the stiffness of the system. So the stiffness is df dx, the rate of change in force as a function of displacement. So again, if we start out with a fiber with a particular stiffness and the hair bundle is attached at this end, if we move the base back and forth, or better, if the hair bundle tries to move, it confronts a certain stiffness. That's no secret. But if I want to control that stiffness, I can do so as follows. Let's suppose the hair bundle moves a certain distance to your right, like that. It will feel a certain force owing to the stiffness of the fiber. If I want the fiber to look stiffer, when the hair bundle moves, say, one unit to your right, I can move the base of the fiber one unit to the left. So it now is going to produce twice as much force on the bundle. So the bundle thinks the fiber is twice as stiff as it really is. Or alternatively, if the hair bundle moves a certain distance to your right, I can move the base of the probe also to the right. In that case, the fiber looks softer than it actually is. So I can dial in whatever stiffness, even negative stiffnesses, I want just by using this feedback system to implement that type of a clamp. So the experimental, the theory that I showed you before makes the prediction about what the state diagram of this system should be. With the two control parameters of elastic load and constant force, the expectation is that there should be an oscillatory region, somewhat like the one that Pascal showed you yesterday, within which the hair bundle will oscillate spontaneously. And outside that, there should be monostable and bistable regions in which the hair bundle sits still unless it's driven by noise, which will of course make it bounce back and forth, but it won't spontaneously oscillate. And around the region of oscillation, there are a line of Hopf bifurcations. There are supercritical Hopf bifurcations here, subcritical Hopf bifurcations here. The theory additionally suggests that as we move towards the head of this fish-shaped thing, one should see a change in amplitude, namely, it should get smaller in this direction, with the biggest amplitude here at the tail of the fish. And conversely, if we move towards the head of the fish, the frequency of oscillation should increase. So here are actual experimental data. The outer region, shown in black, is the region in which no oscillation was observed. So indeed, there is this fish-shaped locus in which there is oscillation surrounded by a stable region. This confirms that it looks like a fish. If you move across this transect, you can see the actual experimental records. Here the response is relatively large. These are spontaneous oscillations, I should say. Here it becomes smaller and smaller, and finally becomes passive by various statistical measurements. So we have a change in frequency. These are low frequency. These are high amplitude. These are progressively lower amplitude. These are low frequency. These are progressively higher frequency in keeping with the theory. One can also see that the system is optimized for responding to stimuli around the bifurcation. So if we make, in this case, measurements at three positions on the two sides of the bifurcation, in the quiescent regime, which corresponds to points just outside the fish over here, one finds that the response is low and it's not highly tuned. And in fact, a passive system is shown by the dotted line. But just inside the oscillatory region, in the head of the fish, one sees sharp tuning and a much higher response. Here's another example. In this case, we've traversed an oscillation. I'll start on the quiescent side, moving to lower and lower stiffnesses until we traverse a bifurcation. And what you can see is, as we do so, the response gets bigger and bigger and bigger, peaks, and then actually starts getting smaller again as we move farther into the head of the fish. And if we measure vector strength, which is a measurement of the phase entrainment of the system, that's also optimized right in the region of this bifurcation. Now, one problem that's still outstanding and that we're quite interested in is how a system can optimize its responsiveness. It would be useful, what we think is happening in fact, is if the system turns itself down or turns itself off when we're in a really loud environment. We would like to operate out here. As we move into a quieter environment, maybe this room, we want maybe a little bit of amplification, a little bit sharper tuning, but we don't need too much. As we move into a very quiet environment, we would like to operate at what seems to be an optimal position just inside the head of the fish. And if you go into a sound booth, absolute silence, one moves farther into the fish and gets spontaneous oscillation. Now, there are a number of ways in which this can be done. Frank Hulicker and his colleagues have suggested one, and he may be able to talk some about that next week. There's been recent exploration of this by Andrew Malevsky, who's here with us today, about another possibility, which is a homeostatic mechanism in which there is some slow variable that is used to tune the system, not to move the operating point, but rather to move the locus of points around the operating point, as shown here. The idea is that without this homeostatic equation, one has a fish. This is the region of spontaneous oscillation in white, and these are regions nearby of progressively high, middle, low sensitivity. When this system is turned on, the region of spontaneous oscillation grows, and in addition, the areas of high, middle, and low sensitivity get bigger and bigger. So in other words, this system is more able to accommodate an operating point, wherever it happens to be, in a region that is to which it is very sensitive. And I hope you'll have an opportunity to speak with Andrew about this. The last thing I want to mention, first of all, is simply a technical issue, why we happen to be working on this system. It turns out, to our surprise, I think, that this set of cells have been really valuable for biophysical investigation. The cells are quite stereotyped. So when you see an electron micrograph of a cell, it looks very beautiful. And like most electron micrographs, one can assume that it's one of a kind. You know, usually you select the one micrograph that you want to call typical that you find out of hundreds and hundreds. But these guys, as you can see, all do look alike. They're very stereotyped, which is really valuable for comparing one cell to the next. They're relatively accessible experimentally, particularly those from the frog. We have the ability to measure and to control conjugate variables. So we can measure displacement and force, we can measure voltage and current. So we can really talk about the energetics of processes, about power gain, and so on. There are few relevant degrees of freedom. The problem with most biological systems, as far as a physicist is concerned, is that they're wet and sloppy and they're full of a whole lot of biochemicals doing various things. These cells allow you to disregard all of that. There are really mostly two degrees of freedom that matter. One is a single axis of hair bundle motion back and forth. The other is the one we don't have a direct handle on, the state of adaptation. And finally, the system is optimized to operate at near threshold levels and to be very energetically efficient. And both of those tend to drive it to interesting behaviors that we have discussed and will discuss farther. The other thing I want to say about this amplificatory mechanism is it seems to be very ancient. So this represents a cladistic tree. It does not include arthropods and other good animals for which I apologize, except to point out that at this point, diptera and insects appeared. And diptera and insects are good to eat. So when diptera and insects appeared, five independent times in the tetrapod vertebrate line, a tympanic ear was evolved. So before bugs, it wasn't necessary to have high frequency hearing. When the bugs appeared, suddenly there was a lot of protein in the air, which had not been the case before. And these really seem to be legitimate, different evolutionary events. You don't find in any of these precursors a tympanic ear. What I want to point out is there's been questions about somatic motility. That's the electromotility owing to the contraction of outer hair cells. That's a relatively recent invention. It appeared somewhere here in the line, the synapsida, that leads to mammals. We don't know exactly when, but it's uniquely there and possibly also occurring in birds. So these are the dinosauria, including birds. And there's some evidence from Robert Fetterplace's group that a Preston-based amplificatory system may contribute there as well. But it's certainly not an ancient process. On the other hand, the active hair bundle motility that I've been talking about is first found at least in the lamprey line. So it is really ancient. It dates to the very beginning of the vertebrata, and it may go back earlier. Now, obviously, as you heard from Daniel's talk today, there are very analogous systems, at least in certain insects. They seem to be implemented by different molecules in different ways. So apparently, these types of active amplifiers have been discovered at least twice, but they are quite ancient. And I'll stop at that point. Yes, sir. I should remember to pass this thing around or we'll get our wrists slapped. No, I'm sure there were other sounds at relatively high frequencies earlier, but the paleontological record seems very striking that it was right around the Permian extinction or shortly after that, which is when the dipterans appeared, that all of these five different lineages developed the tympanic ear. So that's the only justification that anybody has come up with. Do you know of any other rationale?
Yes, we have another example whereby end of Triassic, but for sure by 165 million years, we've got the evolution of singing in Orthoptera. And we were able to reconstruct the song of a fossil, basically a fossil cricket, which shows that they were singing at around 5-6 kilohertz already back then. So that would fit very well with what you are showing here, is that as there are a lot of insects advertising for their mating behaviors, there are a lot of predators like the old the older solenodons also that will be actually having, first evidence that I know of, some sort of a cochlea evolving at the same time.
So that was around the same
and that period, was around the same
in
time.
In the Permian or something?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
But okay. Definitely by the Jurassic, that was all set. Yeah.
Okay. Would you pass the microphone back?
I have two quick questions. How come the relevant dimensionality of the bundle movement is so low dimensional? It seems like the bundle could go in all kinds of directions. Is that because it's pinned to the membrane above it and that membrane only slides?
No. What actually happens is in the cochlea, the nature of basilar membrane motion and of tectorial membrane motion more or less constrains things to move in one axis, because the tectorial membrane here and the basilar membrane here are both hinged like that. So the only way they can move is basically up and down like that. And a hair bundle, now somewhat large, a hair bundle bridging the gap between the two can only move radially. In the other organs, again, in the spirit of telling the truth, the hair bundles, in fact, can move along those other axes. And if you ask, how does the hair bundle move when it's driven off axis, the response very nicely follows a cosine relation. So in other words, the response simply looks at the projection along that axis of sensitivity. So what the ear, or I should say, what organs that use the hair cell for other purposes do is to represent all different orientations. So if we look at the utricle or the saccule, which are the organs, as I mentioned, that are sensitive to linear accelerations, and if we draw a vector indicative of the axis of sensitivity of a given cell, in the saccule, you find cells that best respond to each of these specific orientations, and then there's a reversal, and each of those orientations is represented. And this would be in the human ear on the order of 10,000 cells total, so quite a few of them of each of these orientations. So if I move in a particular direction, this bunch of cells will be maximally stimulated, this bunch of cells will be maximally inhibited, and the others will fall off as the cosine, and the brain deals with all that information.
Got it. One more. The resonant peak in the hair cell bundle seems to be centered on the passive peak, whereas in the schematics you were showing in the very beginning, and I think it's the case in the mammalian cochlea, the outer hair cell resonant peak, if you want to call it that, is sort of displaced from the peak that the underlying passive basilar membrane motion would have. What is that about? Why is there a displacement in one?
Well, so you'll see more of that next week when we talk about how the basilar membrane itself works. But basically, a passive basilar membrane is a relatively poorly tuned structure. And Pascal showed yesterday the original results from von Beckesche, which vexed people, because the tuning from that passive basilar membrane was much weaker and much less sharp than what was known to be the human auditory acuity. And what wasn't appreciated, and what we need to discuss, is the fact that everything is not operating as a series of linear filters, say staged one after another. Instead, the system has a great deal of internal feedback, and one has to look at the modes of the whole apparatus. And that those modes, when the cochlea is active, greatly sharpen the motion of the basilar membrane. So it isn't just that the hair bundle is greatly sharpened, but the basilar membrane's tuning sharpens up as well. Sure. Yeah, you'll get in trouble with you.
I know. I'll get in trouble with authority. Right. Still struggling with something you said in the beginning about the stimulus doing negative work.
Yes.
And, you'd think that the stimulus at some point, right, should be doing positive work. So is something changing? So when you, let's say, rapidly turn on your stimulation, so is there some transient in the sign of the work there?
No, it's not that. It's something as follows. If I have something that is a spontaneous oscillator and it has some natural frequency, and I happen to try to drive it a little below its natural frequency, my driving may entrain it, but it will be trying to lead my stimulus. Yes. And that's what's happening, is that the stimulus is successfully entraining it, but it's constantly pushing on the fiber saying, hurry up, hurry up, hurry up. And therefore, it is, the hair bundle is dissipating work against the fiber.
Okay, fine. But then it can be either side, it just depends on mistuning.
That's right. It depends. And so if the fiber is trying to go too fast, then it will be doing work on the hair bundle.
And then there would still be a transient.
There'll be a transient as well, but
frequency, right?
Yeah, but the result I was showing you is a steady state.
Yeah.
I mean, as long as you keep this up, it will still be the case.
I understand. But if we were to actually look closely at the transient, presumably we would see some other behavior going on as there's some phase locking between whatever
yes.
the bundle is doing
yes.
And the stimulus.
That's definitely the case, yeah. Dolores.
You might have partly answered the question, but for the frog hair cell, as far as I'm aware, the highest Q factor anyone's measured is about 3. To what extent would you then expect, say, a mammalian cell or a chicken cell or any of the other species to have a hair cell with a different higher Q factor, better resonance, or is it entirely in the, as you mentioned, the coupling? Basically, would you expect the hair cells themselves to show any difference? If you pick a 20 kilohertz cell from a mammal, say.
Yeah. I don't know the entire answer to that. I mean, I can only speculate, but I think the key thing you did mention already and Pascal talked about yesterday is the coupling. We are artifactitiously looking at individual hair cells and individual hair bundles, which first lack their ordinary load, though we're trying to replace that load with our clamp system. And secondly, we're looking at them in isolation. And that's key because we think that in most cases, these cells are coupled to varying extents mechanically with their neighbors. So here we have 10,000 cells, and as you know in the sacculus, you can probably think of cohorts of at least a few hundred operating together because they're getting more or less the same stimulus. So that helps cancel out noise, but it also helps with issues of the sort you're talking about. It presumably will raise the Q. And there's evidence from Pascal and from others that that actually operates. So, you know, my expectation is in the mammalian cochlea, that will be the major process. We'll have on the order of 100 hair cells determining the Q, not just one. Okay, thanks. Let's switch computers.
Thanks, Jim.
There's a pointer also. Sure.
Have you tried different kinds of stimulus? So for example, instead of superpositions of sines and cosines, perhaps other more natural, like showing something that might be more akin to a natural sound with more natural statistics?
No, we've never done that. I don't know of anybody else who has. Dolores, Pascal?
A lot of people have talked about it, but I don't think anyone's actually done it.
Yeah. I think our philosophy is we've got enough problems already. And we've seen yesterday what speech does, and it's terrifying.
It would be interesting to see at least if the models, the nonlinear dynamical models, how would they respond to the natural sounds?
I think you can do it with